I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more extraordinary books I've read in recent years is The Measure of a Man by J.J. Lee. The book was released a year ago to great acclaim. It's since been nominated for the country's major literary prizes, the Charles Taylor Prize for Nonfiction, the Governor General's Literary Award, and the B.C. Book Prize's Hubert Evans Nonfiction Prize. This past week, it was announced that the book is a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers' Trust Prize, which I believe is the country's richest prize. It's been reviewed as a heartwarming, heartbreaking, exquisite, and beautiful book. It's a memoir about a stormy childhood, his father's less-than-stellar role in his growing up, and coming to terms with his dad after his death. A way Mr. Lee does that is through this suit he inherits from his father that he renovates to fit himself. It's a marvelous way to enter and unpack this complicated relationship. Along the way, the book takes us on a marvelous social history of the suit. J.J. Lee is an architect by trade, but he's a regular menswear contributor to the Vancouver Sun and CBC Radio here in Vancouver. The book is published by McClelland and Stewart. The website for more is at jjlee.com. That's jj-lee.com. There are a couple of appearances of note. This Sunday, the 30th of September, J.J. Lee will be appearing on a panel with her old friend Charlie Smith, Kevin Chong, and Roberta Staley at Word on the Street. That's at noon. And Saturday morning, the 20th of October, 2012, there's a seminar at the Surrey International Writers Conference. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant Online program, joining me in my office and studio, as it were, J.J. Lee. Mr. Lee, good morning.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This book, as I've told you on emails that we've exchanged, really struck a chord with me because it made me think about my own life and whatever relationships I have in my life. Have you found over the last year or so that you've been out talking about this book that it's struck a similar chord with readers?
Yeah, I mean, people do write to me and approach me about their experience of reading, and often they're quite confessional about their relationship with their own parents, and I'm kind of ill-equipped to sometimes deal with the information that they disclose, but it's also because I think the book touched them and they trust me and they want to share their experiences, and in some ways they're very generous in and of themselves because they're letting me know that I'm not alone in my own experience, which sometimes it feels that way. You feel kind of isolated through bad relationships with your parents. But, I mean, I think every child feels that way. I think that all children have unique relationships with their parents, and because of that uniqueness, they do feel isolated. So it's interesting when people do come up to me and tell me about their father. Some of the relationships are quite excellent. They're not narratives of despair, but actually great warmth and love. And sometimes I worry that people worry on my behalf because they read the book and it seems so sad, but I don't find it a sad book, and I don't find it my father an unloving person. So it's interesting. It's interesting to encounter all these tales from other people.
Do you think because you were so brutally honest about yourself and about your growing up that it encourages people to come up to you and tell you their life story, say?
I don't know if I was brutally honest. I mean, I didn't.
It just seems to me that you were.
I mean, you kind of have to be, I guess, to a degree unflinching. I think some of the challenges in writing the book was to disclose what happened, which was very easy to do, but at the same time to try to protect myself. And so there is a bit of, you have to do some degree of hide and seek, and you have to measure how much you need to tell the reader. I suppose that's what, don't get me wrong. It's a very upfront book. And I suppose that may have been why people are speaking to me, because I do not turn away from it. And I do not, actually the hard part was is trying to find enough good stuff to balance out a portrayal of my father. And that, even in the exercise, was looking for narrative balance, to look for a way to be with my father and try to remember happier moments in our lives was actually a great benefit to me, because it, in many ways I did recover not only the bad but the good in that experience of writing the memoir.
And looking back at the book and seeing your childhood, it seems to me that after you were of age, say a certain age, you tried to forget a lot, because a lot of this book is It seems to me in writing it that you had to recover a lot of things that you purposely forgot.
Yeah, and I feel bad about using the word recovery because you tend to think of it like under hypnosis or some other form of repressed memory. And I don't know what the diagnosis would be. I'm not a person who visits therapist or anything like that. I mean, in many ways, I began to take, and this is the interesting thing, and I think this is at the heart of memoir writing and all narrative forms, is that we can take fragmented images, and much like in comic books, we actually tell the story between the frames. And so when I began to gather those fragmented images and never took the time, and this is where the so-called recovery begins. We all have fragmented images in our past where they don't fit into any coherent narrative. And it's when we begin to put them cheek by jowl in a narrative sequence, and then we begin to build the linkages between, you know, let's say a crushed teacup and a pomegranate and a red wall. And that became the pivotal moment and the first moment of abuse that my father, the first act of violence against my mother that I remember. And I only had those fragments, so I began to understand that they were actually they worked together in a narrative structure. So that was fascinating. And then I also had the benefit of talking to my siblings about that night, and they helped me clarify what did happen indeed.
So there is some research that one does, even though it's about their life, right? You do have to talk to your siblings. You have to talk to your mom, I guess. And
I think the great power, the engine, the motor, the thing, the horsepower of the memoir, because I'm a journalist, the horsepower of this memoir actually came back to revisiting and the idea of trying to reconstruct a memory. So there's an ersatz quality because I do have to talk to my siblings. But in terms of controlling the voice, I mean, once it's like a family photo. Everyone tells you what happens in that photo. And at some point, it becomes your memory. Like the photo, you can tell the story of the photo, even though you actually originally have no memory of that. And in some ways, I think I took some photo images, right, fragmented images, and approached my siblings about it, and they began to imbue me or infuse my own memories with their memories, and so I took them to my own and tried to make sense of them, and so there's this synthetical component to it that's I find fascinating, but I think the research was the engine that made it happen. I don't think I could have gotten as far without speaking with my family. There would have been the gaps would have been very real.
And in the process of coming to terms with your dad, and he's been gone now, what, 10 years or so?
Now it's 11 years now.
11 years. So I understand that the book came out of a documentary that you made for Ideas on CBC. And then you had this suit that was his, that you inherited, and you wanted to fix it so that you could wear it yourself. And so this was your way of coming to terms with the relationship with your dad. And you do that with a suit, and you do that with this book. A year out of this book coming out, are you a lot closer to him, do you think?
I've shifted. A lot of people have come up to me saying, oh, how cathartic it was to write the book. And I've resisted that immensely. Because I was not treated. I went through no treatment, and also the idea of catharsis is actually an aesthetic act and not one that should be understood, I believe, within a therapeutic milieu. So there is catharsis in the book because all great art aspires to create that in the reader. And so I did that. And I think people have projected the catharsis of the book, right, which is there is a literary aspect, an artistic aspect to the book, and projected into my life. And I have tried to resist that with people. Indeed, I felt an immense relief and a sense of understanding of my father the day I typed the pages where I thought about my father and accepted him for who he was. But that doesn't abate further thought or feeling about my father. And so it's more like a tide, the ebb and flow, it's come in and out. And so I'm in, now I'm kind of fearful. Someone asked recently what my father would think of this book, and that sent a chill in my heart. The sense of, you worry about betrayal, and no one wants to see themselves as a betrayer of their father. So that's where I'm at. Like, if you really want to, that's kind of, you know, I wonder what's going to happen next. If I ever meet him again, you know, after the veil, passing through the veil, what would he say? I'm very intrigued by that.
I was reading online discussions that people have had of the book, and there were a few people that got together, I guess, for the Vancouver Sun Book Club. They got together to read the book and then talk about it. And a couple of the people, the panelists on there, said that after reading the book, they didn't like your dad, and that they thought he was a bad person. As a son, do you get defensive about that? I do.
Ian Weir, the novelist, actually put it like, why the fuck would he want to wear that suit? Is what you know? You can bleep that out if you wish.
No,
but and it shocked me, right? Yeah. Because I really wrote the book with a lot of love, and this is what I did learn after, because Ian's words have haunted me since he made those comments for a very long time. It's been months. This is what I learned. I come from my father, and that's why I'd actually describe from my mother tells a story, but I reverse the perspective of how my mother and father met and how they made love for the first time. And so I tell it more with my father being the subject, the person taking action in that relationship. And I come from that moment, and it was profound to think that, you know, love, you know, I came out of a moment of love, and to deny that and to somehow tell myself a narrative where I did not come from something giving, something beautiful, what would that make me? So even out of just blind self-preservation, much like the self-preservation of trying to not emulate my father or to dwell on things so that I would become like my father, my self-preservation meant a fragmented memory for a good long time. I think in some ways I grasp on the good of my father because that's what I need from my father. And the exercise of re-remembering or recovering or whatever you want to call it, or building the narrative strand so that my life wasn't just a bunch of pieces and I felt I had no legacy or I came from no legacy, was really important and was a powerful experience for me and something that I'm really intrigued in examining in in my next memoir. So I'll be looking at those things. And we need the fathers. We have to create the fathers that we need, one way or another.
And do you think whatever relationship you had with your dad, good, bad, or whatever, that obviously affects how you're a dad yourself, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and the introspection that you take in terms of thinking about these things, in writing a book, say, it's a lot more than most people would think about their life or their past. Do you think you understand life better?
I think I understand my life better,
yeah.
And I'm like the worst person to give advice, because first of all, I give advice, yeah. Which you should never do,
yeah.
And number two is I don't know how correct it is, the advice I give them, but I am a dispenser of wisdoms sometimes to my friends,
yeah.
And I suffer greatly from that, I'm certain, or they do, rather. I would have to say that I'm lucky that I was asked to look into my life with my father and given the opportunity to really reflect upon it. And while I would never create a self-help book on fatherhood, maybe I will, because I do have a lot to say about it, and I do use what I learned about myself to create some sort of leverage with my children, to create my twin boys, Jack and Emmett, to create a better life for them somehow through those lessons. And if I didn't, I mean, most of this exercise would be worthless. So, yes, I do think about it a lot. I still do, and it's a major project in my life.
Yeah, and do you think you have a better life because of all of this?
Than before?
Yeah.
I know my sons have a better life.
Yeah.
I don't know if I immensely improved mine. And I wasn't seeking that. I didn't need to have a better life. I feel enriched from having a better relationship with my memory of my father. I don't know about my relationship with my father. The relationship with my father is kind of seized in a way. He's deceased. But the journey to come to some sort of conclusion has been rich. And I always think about the Road to Perdition, which was originally a graphic novel and then became a movie, of course, quite famously. and with Tom Hanks, and he just, you know, he was my father, is I think the last line in the film by the narrator, and I feel comfortable with that.
You mentioned your twin sons. They're 8 years old.
That's right.
Yeah. Do they ask about their grandfather?
Oh, tons. And they're very aware of the book, and they've read parts of it, and they've tried. And I don't keep the book away from them by any means. They can open. They're welcome to open up the book and read any page that they wish. And we tell them the story. I tell them all the good things that we're doing. I probably learned from my dad. Hmm. All the things that I'm trying to do with you. Is the good stuff, and I'll make up a couple. And so we have our own traditions, and we aspire to do things together. And I'm always trying to. In some ways, I feel like sometimes it's like I'm a stage director. I'm staging their lives a bit. I'm creating this circumstance so that they have these strong memories that will help them hopefully in the future.
Your siblings, what have they thought of the book?
Oh. It was alarming. I was very worried. No one vetted the book prior to publication in my family. My sister, I mean, it's an old story, but I told my sister Tammy that I wouldn't use her name because she asked me not to, and then I entirely forgot that.
Mm.
And I wrote the whole thing using her name, and it went to public. And then, of course, she reads it 2 weeks later after its publication. She goes, "I read the book. And you use my name." but it was, she loved the book. She felt it was a loving portrayal. And it, you know, I don't think I exposed anyone in any terribly embarrassing way. So everyone's really happy with the book. And they, what's shocking is the amount, how they feel that it represents exactly what happened. And that often doesn't happen in memoirs, that every sibling has a different perspective. But they love the book, and they definitely think it captures a moment.
And at the end of your, this is stuff that I've been curious about ever since I finished the book a while ago. And if I'm intruding, you'll tell me, and we'll move on. The relationship that you had with your dad at the end of his life, was it closer than, say, the relationship your siblings had with him?
That's a he lived. So we came from Montreal, and when my father divorced, he came out to Vancouver, and then I followed him, and I don't even know why I did, but essentially, you would have to break it down, I did indeed follow him. We were close because I saw him at the end.
Yeah.
He was only 10 minutes away when he died, and I hadn't seen him in a whole year. So I don't think that's a definition of being close.
But was the relationship with the other with your siblings
terrible?
Was worse than
no? It's terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. You notice in the book I don't actually speak about how my siblings feel, and I do think that we're entering sort of a
sure.
It's interesting. I mean, I haven't really asked them. It was kind of a selfish book in many ways, despite the fact that I interview my siblings. It's I do really focus on a father and son dyad. In the writing, and I hope that, you know, through the specificity of my experience, that it actually becomes universal. But you know, sometimes I would write, and I'm so tired of using the word I, mm-hmm. you know, the pronoun I, and I would find other ways to create sentences just to displace myself. And I think I did that. But in the end, it is that dyadic relationship between my father and I that's sort of worked through.
And in talking to your mom. About in the course of writing this, did she give you any insight as to your own relationship with your father? Like, did she have observations that you probably didn't take note of?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing is one day we had a very difficult conversation about that first attack on my mother, and she called an hour later and she goes, "You know, your father loved you.
Yeah,
he really, really loved you." And she kept on, and it was like. She felt like she had opened something up and didn't know how to close it again. And so she was trying to, you know, I don't know if it was, like a thumb in the dike kind of situation, but she kept on saying, you know, he really loved you. And it was somehow reassuring. My mother has that ability to soothe me quite easily, like just her yammering, I call it. And I love it. But there was a funny reaction there. I mean, she just wanted... It's very funny. My family's quite artistically ambitious in many ways. And my mother said, just write the best book you can. Like, write a great book. And I listen, you know, and I really you know, try my best.
The sense of fashion that you have, it seems to me, came at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really from your father?
There's a big chunks from my father, like the loafers. Like, you know, there's a scene where I'm clacking around, and those are really powerful moments. And indeed, that vibration from the master bedroom closet. I used to visit his suits, and it's one of the chapters in the book. I used to visit his suits when I was very young and dress up, and that's normal for every child. But the mystery of the world that the suits led him into was definitely what haunted me. And there's a part I don't even write about in my 20s where I would wear a tie all the time prior to his death. And I never understood why I did that. And it could only come, and it was always his knot, the half Windsor. And now I'm more of a bow tie person and a four in hand knot person because it actually suits me better. But just that's really when the research of trying to uncover my connection to my father, the one that I didn't recognize before, is when I noticed that I was using the half Windsor knot and that there were actually many other knots that I could use. So, I mean, you can't shake it. And, you know, the interesting thing, and the thing that I think people forget, is that it's not actually a unique relationship. All fathers inform their sons on how to dress. Whether they reject it or embrace it, there is always that. Clothes comes really quickly into the equation of when a father tries to teach a son how to be a man. Clothes figures into it really early.
That's sort of the first example, I guess, we have.
Yeah.
Well, when we're trying to dress up as a grown-up, I guess we look at our dad.
Yeah, and there's sartorial conflict. The idea of, like, you know, if your father doesn't like ripped jeans because it reflects poorly on him, well, that's the beginning of a discussion about, you know, what role does a father have in your sartorial education. And it's there, and I think that's a very delicate matter, because I actually advise a lot of people on their clothes, either through friendships or through my column, or through my, you know, I've worked with a charity on you know, how to dress young men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're actually entering, you do feel guilt, because you do enter this really delicate matter of intruding in a father-son relationship, and maybe even displacing that father-son relationship. So I'm very, it's essential. It's one of the, you know, it's fiction in my way, because I've never experienced that. You know, a father takes a son to a tailor, you know, for some reason, for their first suit. It can be a really powerful experience.
Modernized Tailors is this shop that's in Chinatown, and it's been there for 100 years.
Yeah.
You went there to work as an apprentice. You talk about that in the book. That's one of the streams, I guess, of the book. There's sort of three: the social history, your own family, and then this idea of you trying to go into the tailoring business. You worked with Bill Wong as his apprentice. I guess you were looking for a father in Bill, weren't you?
It's funny, because I mean, it's, you know, any like grade 11, grade 9 English student will recognize the theme really quickly. But we never, you know, we kind of suppressed it in the book. We didn't bang that drum too hard until the end. There's a little bit of a, you know, I had to give in and just acknowledge, you know, that's what had happened to me. But it's funny, I kind of pushed that. I do try to give Bill his own space, you know, and in a way, because there's that sense of loyalty to my father not to displace him, you know, for good or bad, displace his memory and sort of supplant him with Bill. But yes, indeed, Bill is an exceedingly generous person, especially to me. Sometimes it's easier to be nicer to strangers than it is to your own family.
Yeah.
And that's a common thing, you know, when you see your father with, like, your best friend or just, you know, something odd like that, right? And so, so Bill's been a really great elderly figure in my life, and we still maintain a relationship. I was just there yesterday, mm-hmm. hanging out with him, and so we still try to keep in touch. I mean, it's difficult, but we do try to stay in touch.
Did you have a suit or a jacket from Modernize?
I have two.
Yeah,
I have two full suits done by them, and then I have little projects that they've done for me.
Yeah, and I guess I can't ask how much a suit would cost there, can I?
No, I don't. No, I've made him so famous. Yeah. I've priced myself out, or he's priced himself out of my range. I can't I can't afford a suit from Bill anymore.
Is that the same as like when we read about Savile Row and bespoke clothes? Is that what they do here?
No. They're always a made-to-measure outfit. So yeah. They have set blocks that they use based on measurements that are taken from the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And they adjust the block, it's called, to make the suit. And then they use, and there's a different, you know, stitching strategies. The interlining in the suit is more commercial. So they use more, at Modernize, more of the materials that you would find in a factory-made suit. But there's the trying on that you can have by visiting Park, who's the coat maker.
Mm-hmm.
You would visit Park when the sleeves aren't on, and they would mark up where they put the shoulders, and there's a lot of adjustments that can be made. The buttonholes haven't been made yet, and so you get a made-to-measure experience. There's a little edge of custom, you know, custom detailing that can go on, but it's certainly not. Savile Row is quite a precise, and it has precise things that you need to do to be considered Savile Row now.
Yeah,
Savile Row bespoke, it's called, and like hand stitching in certain areas, and so. In Modernize, it's a bit loose, and it's really, this is what makes it so fun. I really, sometimes I worry that male readers aren't engaging in the book because it's fashion oriented, but so much of what I like about fashions is very much the same reason why I like baseball, or I like reading about motorcycle engines. It has a lot of precision and a lot of details, and I think, you know, I enjoy that kind of stuff, and I find suits endless source of interest for me because of those details that can emerge and the precision at which suits can be made.
When you go around town looking at how men are dressing, how are we doing as a city?
Depends what part of the city. I'm actually surprised. The Howe Street crowd is quite, you know, they look like any other business district crowd in any part of the world. So actually, I'm quite impressed by that. Because I was in London, I was kind of appalled by kind of the clothes I saw. Even within two blocks of Savile Row, you would see poorly dressed men. I do think we're a much more relaxed city. And in some ways, there's fewer occasions to dress up in the first place. It's kind of a B-minus, though. You know, what can you say? And it's funny because, I've been in Vancouver for 20 years, and every time I go to like Montreal or Toronto or New York, I wonder how I will be perceived. And because I'm a hick in fashion terms, right? Like we're from this much more regional city.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it's funny because you can sort of hold your own, you know, if you have your own sense of style and your own sense of playfulness around clothes. And indeed, people, like, there's a scene actually of me going to New York just with my rags and making a big splash amongst some models.
They thought you were a jean designer.
And so it's funny how that can happen. Sometimes being left alone in a region is perfectly fine for developing a unique sense of style.
Are you when you are, let's say, on the SkyTrain or on the bus or walking down the street, because I dressed up today for you coming in here, are you judgmental about how people are dressing?
I'm not judgmental. I want to save people.
Yeah.
Because I can read the clothing. For example, that's not a suit, right?
No, it's just a jacket.
A jacket, and there's black pants underneath. And
gray
so
pants.
It's a gray pants. It's charcoal gray.
Yeah.
So and so I was going, it's not quite a blazer. So how do you make that gray pant? I mean, you're always sort of working on how to save the suit or save the look, right? And I was looking at Joseph is wearing a blue pocket square.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I was going, how deep blue is it? Is it bordering on black? You know, how do we get balance? You know, how do we get balance out of the suit? So I do notice things, I tell myself a story based on how you're dressed and how everyone's dressed. But I never judge. Any effort is in. I've learned this. Alan Flusser says this, the author of Dressing the man who dressed Michael Douglas for the film Wall Street, said a very profound thing to me. He says, "You have to be encouraging. You have to be encouraged when you see people trying." And so I am, and I always am. It's exciting. And what I worry about, sometimes people go, I have to get a custom-made suit after they read the book. And I don't think that's the actual conclusion you can draw from the book. Actually, there's a certain freedom in the book about trying to find your own way and to not care about what the Beau Brummels or the fashionistas have to say. So I want people to feel, if they're interested, I want them to feel in command and to transcend the rules at some point, to punch through the other side. Like I'm wearing today, I was very strategic. I decided to wear linen, and this is after September 21st.
Yeah.
Way after Labor Day. And the reason why is I'm doing my own experiment. It's called blown linen.
Mm-hmm.
It's linen suits that begin to fall apart. It's kind of like worn out jeans kind of idea. So I want to work the suit till it's black linen, but it's going on to gray now, and it's going to eventually start reading as blue. And I'm interested in that experience. And so I don't care if no one can come up to me and go, well, you know, it's after Labor Day, you should be wearing linen. And that's what I want men to do. I want men to stop caring. Like, I'm wearing a burgundy tie, a pink shirt, and I have red socks on. You're not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Right? But at some point, I want men to feel in command, so much in command that they don't care. I always get comments. People, and I suppose I dress this way just so I can have conversations with strangers. People always have something to say about my clothing, and I find that intriguing, and I like it. And it's not the peacock syndrome. It's about providing an opening for conversation and being looking like you're an open person. I sometimes think, oh gosh, I've dressed eccentrically. Like, I'm very eccentric today, and I don't mind that.
Yeah.
I think it provides people, you know, it's a way of overcoming alienation, urban alienation. So I really want young men and men who aspire to dress well to begin to punch through that and, you know, learn what they need to learn, but then with great confidence step out of the mold.
And it doesn't cost very much. I mean, we, one picks up the book, they would think that, you know, having to dress well would cost a great deal, but it doesn't.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm just an ink-stained wrench. Right? Like, I can't really, you know, I don't drop thousands of dollars on clothes.
Yeah.
Though I'd like to.
I think we all would. Yeah.
I do think it's about style and not about fashion, and that's why I feel very ill at ease reporting on trends, because I'm not that kind of guy. I have no interest in trends, personally, and I have no interest in. That's not true. It shouldn't be so. I mean, if someone wants to fly me to Milan, I'll happily go. But that's not my area of expertise by any means. And I feel very uncomfortable because I'm not in that milieu. I'm not in Paris and London and New York and Milan. But I can. I feel I can talk about style. I can talk about dressing in a way that makes you happy. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. You mentioned that you're working on another memoir.
Yes.
Yeah. What will that be about?
It will be about fatherhood. I think I need to follow up on my experience of being a father. And what's happened is that as the boys get older, I begin to remember more about my relationship with my sons. And in some ways, it's going to be a bit revisionist, because I'll have to look back at my life with my father in a whole new light because of the things are surfacing that I didn't understand before, even when I wrote the book. And, you know, I definitely made, after the book, people have, like, corrected me. And these are causal corrections. People are telling me, like, you know, this is how it happened. It didn't happen quite that way. So I'm, like I said, I'm very interested in the nature of memoir. And so, in a way, I'm very interested in also my role in the construction of my children's memory. So this idea of memoir and memory coming cheek by jowl in real life, right? Memoir tends to close the book on memory.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to reopen it, and I'm trying to mess around with that. So I'm very, I don't know if what I'll be writing is going to be understood as a memoir, though.
Yeah.
Or can be accepted as a memoir.
This is such an extraordinary book. I wanted to talk to you for a long time, but it took me a while to read it because I've had to think about my own life, but I have thought about this book for a long time. All the praise that you've been getting, all the critical success, it's so well deserved. I appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you.
The book is called The Measure of a Man, The Story of a Father, a Son, and a Suit. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. The website for more, jj-lee.com. JJ Lee joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.